So think about it like this. You wouldn't move your family into a house made only of a concrete slab, right?
I mean, I definitely wouldn't.
Right, because you can pour the foundation, you know, let it set and admire the footprint, but you can't actually live there until you run the plumbing, install the security system, and put a roof over your head.
Yeah, exactly. Only then do you have a functional, secure structure.
Which is funny because for the past few years, we've essentially watched the European crypto industry trying to live on, well, an unfinished concrete slab.
Yeah, the foundational blueprint was there, but the environmental protections to, you know, actually make it safe for the inhabitants, those were totally still under construction.
And that perfectly brings us to our mission for you on today's deep dive. We are looking at a stack of sources detailing Europe's massive new crypto rulebook. And the timing for you listening is absolutely critical.
Oh, absolutely.
Because as of July 1st, 2026, which was just a few weeks ago, by the way, the final transitional period for crypto firms operating in the European Union officially ended. The grace period is just gone. We have crossed the threshold into the era of active supervisory enforcement.
Right. So the landscape has completely shifted from theoretical preparation to practical demonstration. Like firms are actually being audited now on whether their operational controls work in practice rather than just on paper.
Which means whether you are, say, a compliance officer trying to keep your company out of the crosshairs, or maybe a developer building a decentralized application, or even just an investor trying to understand the future of digital money, we need to decode what is often mistakenly called the EU's comprehensive crypto law.
Ah, yes. MiCA.
Exactly. The markets in crypto assets regulation. The core tension across all our sources today is that word comprehensive. MiCA is historically significant, obviously, but to use the house analogy, MiCA is just that concrete foundation.
Yeah, it really is.
If you want to understand how crypto is truly policed in Europe today, looking only at MiCA is a massive blind spot.
It is. The sources we're looking at really emphasize that MiCA is merely one piece of a highly interconnected, incredibly dense regulatory architecture.
Mm-hmm.
To understand the reality of operating in Europe, you have to examine the entire web.
Right.
You have to look at the rules for transfer traceability, the anti-money laundering controls, the technological resilience mandates, and the aggressive new tax transparency laws. They are all designed to interlock.
So before we build the rest of this regulatory house, we really need to understand exactly what that MiCA foundation actually covers. And just as importantly, who is legally allowed to stand on it? Let's look at the perimeter.
Okay, so the perimeter basically dictates jurisdiction, right? MiCA applies to the issuance, the public offering, and the admission to trading of crypto assets.
Okay.
But it carries a massive exclusionary clause. It only applies to crypto assets that are not already governed by traditional EU financial services legislation.
So if it looks like a traditional stock.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If regulators look at a new token and determine it qualifies as a traditional financial instrument, say a transferable security, because it promises a dividend or voting rights in a corporation, it is immediately kicked out of MiCA.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. And it's subjected to traditional, much heavier securities laws. MiCA is really reserved for assets that fall outside that legacy framework. And it regulates a specific list of crypto asset service providers, or CASPs as they're called, who facilitate the trading, custody, or exchange of those assets.
You know, I saw a massive misconception popping up in the commentary surrounding these sources that we really need to clarify for you. Because Bitcoin is decentralized and has no CEO or central issuer, a lot of people seem to think it gets a free pass in Europe now.
Oh, yeah. That's a huge misconception.
They just assume it's totally excluded from MiCA.
Right. But the regulatory text handles that nuance very deliberately. Bitcoin, the asset itself, inherently lacks a central issuer. You know, regulators cannot subpoena a decentralized protocol.
Obviously not.
Right, so issuer-specific regulations cannot apply to the base asset. However, the businesses that provide services around Bitcoin, the centralized exchanges, the custodial wallet providers, the trading algorithms, those are fully captured under the CSP regime. Regulators control the decentralized asset by aggressively choking the centralized on-ramps and off-ramps.
So the asset remains wild, but the gateways are heavily policed.
Exactly.
I also want to look at how regulators are handling the whole substance over form debate, because we've seen developers, you know, slapping an NFT label on a fractionalized real estate token, basically hoping that calling it non-fungible magically exempts it from financial regulation.
Yeah, but slapping a label on a product offers zero legal protection. European regulators are explicitly instructed to look at the economic reality of the token.
The economic reality.
Right. So If an NFT is part of a massive collection of, say, 10,000 highly similar assets, and it trades on highly liquid secondary markets like a speculative commodity, well, regulators will treat it as a fungible crypto asset. The underlying financial mechanics dictate the regulation, not the marketing terminology.
That makes total sense. Now, assuming a firm plays ball, submits to these mechanics, and secures their MiCA authorization, they unlock a massive commercial advantage, which is the EU passport.
Oh, the passport fundamentally changes the unit economics of a crypto business. It's huge.
How so?
Well, once a CASP is authorized by the national regulator in just one member state, say France or Germany, they inherit a passport to provide those same services across the entire European Union.
Wow.
Yeah. They do not need to establish physical offices, hire local compliance teams, or undergo separate licensing processes in the other 26 member states.
It's basically an operational golden ticket.
Totally.
But for non-EU firms, say an exchange based in Asia or the Caribbean that wants access to European liquidity without submitting to that regulatory burden, the door is essentially slammed shut, right? Minus one tiny keyhole called reverse solicitation.
Right, reverse solicitation. So a non-EU firm can only service an EU client if the client initiates the relationship entirely on their own exclusive initiative. The firm absolutely cannot market to them.
And the regulators clearly saw the loophole here, because in the past, offshore firms would hire a fleet of European influencers or sponsor European football teams or use affiliate links to drive traffic.
Oh, all the time.
Right. And then they'd claim, oh, the customer came to us organically. But the sources note regulators have completely closed that avenue.
Yeah, they have. Regulators are now deploying advanced web scraping, IP tracking, and social media surveillance to prove illicit marketing.
That is intense.
It is. If a non-EU platform is running geo-targeted ads on a European user's social feed or operating a website in an EU language with local currency trading pairs, that completely invalidates any claim of reverse solicitation. The firm is immediately in violation of operating an unauthorized financial service.
Okay, so we have the foundation poured. We know who is allowed in the building. Let's look at the vault. Because the rules surrounding stablecoins and the safeguarding of your assets are some of the strictest in the world.
They really are. And the stablecoin provisions actually front-ran the rest of the regulation. They went live back in June 2024.
Right, way ahead of the rest.
Yeah. Regulators bucketed them into two main categories. First, you have e-money tokens, which seek a stable value by pegging to a single official fiat currency like the euro.
Okay.
And then you have asset reference tokens, which might maintain stability by pegging to a basket of different currencies, commodities, or other crypto assets.
There is a specific detail in the text regarding these tokens that I find absolutely fascinating. Issuers of stablecoins are legally banned from granting interest to token holders.
Yep, completely banned.
If we use an analogy, it's like regulators authorizing a high-tech digital checking account, but explicitly outlawing it from ever acting like a savings account. Why do that?
Well, the underlying logic there stems from a massive fear of shadow banking.
Shadow banking.
Right. If a stablecoin pays interest based on the duration you hold it, the public will inevitably treat it as a high-yield savings account. However, stablecoin issuers do not have access to a central bank lender of last resort, nor do they have government-backed deposit insurance.
Right. So if things go bad.
Exactly. In times of market panic, an interest-bearing stablecoin is highly susceptible to a classic bank run. So by banning the remuneration, the EU forces stablecoins to remain strictly utility vehicles for payment and settlement. They are trying to prevent them from morphing into systemic macroeconomic risks.
Which shifts the risk from the macroeconomic level down to the micro level of the exchange itself. I mean, the history of crypto is literally littered with horror stories of users depositing tokens on an exchange only to discover the exchange's CEO was secretly lending them out to a hedge fund.
A tale as old as time in this industry.
Right. But Mike Huck attacks this commingling of funds directly.
It does. CASPs are now legally required to segregate customer assets from the firm's own estate. In the event of a bankruptcy, those customer assets are totally insulated and cannot be used to pay off the exchange's corporate creditors.
That's a huge relief for users.
It is. And beyond segregation, CASPs must maintain permanent minimum capital requirements.
What are the numbers on that?
Well, it ranges from 50,000 to 150,000 euros, or at least a quarter of their previous year's fixed overheads, whichever is higher.
Okay, I have to put a massive warning sign on that for anyone listening who might misinterpret this. Do not mistake those capital requirements for deposit insurance.
No, absolutely not. The capital requirements basically ensure the firm has enough liquidity to wind down operations in an orderly manner if they go bankrupt. Yeah. They protect against corporate mismanagement.
But they do absolutely nothing to protect you against the underlying volatility of the asset class. If the token you purchased legally and securely drops 90% in value because of market dynamics, you absorb that loss.
Exactly.
So the vault is secure, but the contents of the vault are still highly volatile.
That's a great way to put it. And, you know, you are also heavily exposed to operational failures. You can have the most strictly segregated accounts on the planet, but if a malicious actor compromises the private keys or a catastrophic server failure occurs during a market crash, the financial rules offer very little comfort.
And that's exactly why we need to build the roof on our regulatory house. We need operational resilience, which brings us to DORA, the Digital Operational Resilience Act.
Right. So DORA has been active since January 2025, and it applies broadly to the entire European financial sector, but it explicitly pulls in authorized CASPs.
It pulls everyone in.
Yeah, and it forces these entities to aggressively manage their information and communication technology, or ICT, risk.
What does that actually look like in practice?
Well, they must perform advanced threat-led penetration testing. They have to report major incidents to authorities. And this is the really heavy lift. They have to manage the risk of their third-party tech suppliers.
Like who?
Like cloud hosting providers and data oracles.
You know, when people hear server outage, they usually just think of the inconvenience of a website being down. Oh, I can't check my portfolio.
Right, just an IT headache.
Exactly. But from the perspective of a financial crime team, a technological outage is a severe security vulnerability.
Oh, 100%.
A coordinated DDoS attack crashing an exchange's monitoring systems basically creates the ultimate smokescreen.
Yeah, because while the IT team is scrambling to bring the servers back online, malicious actors are exploiting the blackout to siphon hot wallets, evade sanction screens, or launder funds. Criminals utilize operational chaos.
And DORA aims to harden the infrastructure against that chaos.
Exactly. And accountability for what happens on that infrastructure extends to how these projects actually present themselves to the public.
You're talking about the white papers.
Yeah, the primary marketing vehicle in this space has always been the white paper. Since December 2025, MiCA mandates that these founding documents must be standardized, machine-readable, and published on an official register managed by ESMA, the European Securities and Markets Authority.
Okay, I have to play the skeptic here. I look at that ESMA register and I see a massive risk for retail investors.
How so?
Well, if an average person sees a token's white paper hosted on an official European Union government website, human psychology basically dictates they will assume that project is government approved, vetted, and fundamentally safe. Doesn't this create a dangerous false sense of security?
It's a fair point, but the regulatory texts anticipate that exact psychological trap. The sources are very clear that the white paper is strictly a regulatory disclosure mechanism.
Just disclosure.
Right. It is absolutely not a regulatory endorsement of the business model, the technology, or the token's future value. The liability for the content remains entirely with the issuer.
So why even mandate it?
The standardization merely allows automated supervisory systems to parse the data at scale. They can compare claims across thousands of projects to spot systemic risks or obvious red flags.
I see. So it forces issuers to put their claims down in a standardized format so they can be prosecuted later if those claims turn out to be fraudulent.
Precisely.
And that accountability ties directly into MiCA's strict new market abuse regime, right? The rules targeting insider dealing and market manipulation. But what I don't get is, why not just use traditional stock market surveillance software? I mean, why does it completely fail when you plug it into a crypto exchange?
Well, traditional market surveillance was built for a world with localized exchanges, set trading hours, and singular centralized order books.
Wall Street opens at 9:30 and closes at 4.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But the crypto market operates 24/7. It features extreme cross-platform liquidity, where the exact same asset trades across dozens of global venues simultaneously.
Right.
And more importantly, the activity fragments between on-chain decentralized liquidity pools and off-chain centralized exchanges.
That sounds like a nightmare to track.
It is. A sophisticated manipulation scheme today involves coordinating wash trading across, say, 3 centralized exchanges, while simultaneously manipulating an algorithmic pricing oracle on a decentralized protocol.
Wow.
Legacy surveillance software just cannot see across that fragmented landscape. Detecting this requires highly adapted, crypto-native behavioral analytics.
Okay, so we have the infrastructure hardened, the marketing standardized, and the trading surveilled while the assets are on the platform. But the core utility of crypto is the ability to move it off the platform.
And that's where things get really intense.
Yeah, the moment you initiate a withdrawal, we basically leave the safety of MiCA and run straight into the transfer of funds regulation.
Which is universally known as the travel rule.
Right. Now, in traditional legacy banking, if you wire money internationally, there are usually minimum monetary thresholds before the really aggressive data collection kicks in.
Sure.
But under the EU's crypto travel rule, there is zero threshold. Like, every single transfer, down to a fraction of a cent, must collect and transmit personally identifiable data on both the originator and the beneficiary. It's like attaching a digital luggage tag to every single penny. Why zero threshold?
The necessity of a zero threshold policy stems directly from the underlying technology. Think about it. A physical $100 bill is a single unit.
Okay.
A Bitcoin, however, can be instantly fractionated into 100 million microscopic units called Satoshis. If regulators set a reporting threshold at, say, 1,000 euros, a money laundering syndicate would simply write a basic script to divide millions of dollars into microscopic 99-cent transactions.
Oh, wow.
Yet they'd flood the network and bypass the surveillance entirely. It's a process known as a dusting attack. To eliminate that technological workaround, the EU mandated that every transaction, regardless of size, carries the identity data.
But what if you aren't sending funds to another regulated exchange? What if you are withdrawing to a self-hosted wallet, like a piece of hardware you keep in a physical safe in your own house?
All self-hosted wallets remain entirely legal to use.
Okay, good.
However, if a regulated CSP is facilitating a transfer to or from a self-hosted wallet, and the transfer exceeds 1,000 euros, the provider is legally obligated to take appropriate measures to assess whether the customer actually owns or controls that external address.
How do they even do that?
Usually they accomplish that through cryptographic signature proofs or microdeposits, but verifying ownership is actually only the first step. The anti-money laundering directives demand these firms look much deeper into the history of that wallet.
Wait, really? Deeper how?
Because ownership does not equal innocence.
Hmm.
A firm must analyze the historical blockchain behavior of that self-hosted address.
So they look back in time.
Right. Has that wallet previously interacted with decentralized coin mixers designed to obfuscate transaction trails? Is it receiving funds directly from wallets flagged for ransomware payouts or sanctioned state actors? A user can pass their initial onboarding identity checks effortlessly, but if their self-hosted wallet shows a history of interacting with high-risk infrastructure, the AML alerts will immediately trigger and the transaction will be frozen.
Which brings us to the final and perhaps most impactful layer of this regulatory web, the complete destruction of crypto tax anonymity through DOCA.
Oh, the Directive on Administrative Cooperation? It really expands the regulatory footprint squarely into the realm of taxation.
Yeah, because as of January 1st, 2026, crypto asset service providers are required to automatically aggregate user transaction data, match it to the user's localized tax identification numbers, and push that data via automated APIs directly to national tax authorities.
Automated APIs. It's wild.
And then those domestic authorities share that intelligence cross-border within the EU. The mechanics of this mean that even if you are totally cleared by MiCA, fully compliant with the travel rule, and completely cleared by AML algorithms, if you have been hiding capital gains or offshore income, the automated data pipelines of DC8 will basically expose you to your local tax agency.
Yeah, the tax man cometh, as they say. It systematically dismantles the opacity that early crypto adopters really relied upon for tax evasion.
So looking at this massive interconnected system, you know, MiCA, DORA, the travel rule, AML directives, and DC8, a compliance officer, is tasked with a monumental challenge. The sources outline a methodology to actually operationalize this, which they call the resilient control stack.
Right, the resilient control stack. It is basically a conceptual 7-layer framework for surviving and defending a firm in this new regulatory reality.
Instead of looking at them in isolation, let's look at how these layers actually interact in the real world. The first layer is perimeter analysis. Basically, a firm has to determine if a token is a utility token under MiCA or a security.
Exactly. And once they decide they can legally list it, they move to layer 2, which is counterparty verification.
Which is KYC stuff.
Mostly. This is where you determine the exact legal entity you are doing business with. You know, verifying their corporate structure and beneficial owners to ensure you aren't dealing with a sanctioned entity using a shell company.
Then you combine layer 3, integrated wallet intelligence, with Layer 4 travel rule governance.
Right, they act together.
So if a verified user tries to send a large sum to an external wallet, but the travel rule data payload is missing the beneficiary information, the transaction halts.
Yep, full stop.
The firm then applies wallet intelligence using blockchain analytics to trace the receiving address. If they discover the address is tied to, let's say, a sanctioned North Korean hacking syndicate, they immediately move to Layer 5, transaction surveillance. They freeze the assets and file a suspicious activity report.
And that entire operational workflow must be protected by Layer 6, the DOR operational resilience mandates. Just ensuring a cyber attack cannot take down the surveillance system while the investigation is ongoing.
It's all connected.
It really is. And finally, Layer 7 is continuous regulatory intelligence. It's just the recognition that this landscape is constantly shifting and static compliance models will absolutely fail.
Because even with this dense, multi-layered regulatory fortress fully constructed, the sources openly acknowledge that the framework is already showing cracks.
Yeah, the European Commission has already begun reviewing MiCA's operation in 2026 because, well, technological innovation just outpaces legislative drafting, always.
Fully decentralized finance, or DeFi, remains a massive regulatory gray area. I mean, if a lending protocol operates entirely through autonomous smart contracts with no centralized corporate entity, there is literally no one for regulators to subpoena and no one to enforce the travel rule. Plus, you have complex staking mechanics where users lock up tokens to secure a network in exchange for algorithmic yields. That blurs the lines between technical utility and financial securities. And the relentless game of whack-a-mole continues against non-EU platforms using sophisticated spoofing to bypass those reverse solicitation firewalls we talked about.
Right. So the regulatory perimeter is established, but the edges are constantly being tested by borderless technology.
So we have journeyed through an incredibly dense architecture today. For you listening, the key takeaway is that Europe hasn't just passed a single crypto law. They have built an intricate, highly automated regulatory machine.
A very expensive machine.
Yes. They poured the MiCA foundation, ran the AML plumbing, installed the DORA security cameras, and locked the doors with DACH tax reporting. The true test going forward is effectiveness.
Totally.
Can this heavily surveilled architecture actually stop illicit finance and protect consumers in practice? Or will sophisticated actors continue to find technological workarounds?
And that tension leaves us with a critical, defining question for the next decade of digital finance based on what these sources conclude.
What's that?
Well, now that Europe has constructed this incredibly strict, robust, highly monitored house, what actually happens to the market? Like, will this comprehensive control SPAC become the global gold standard that the United States and Asian markets just rush to replicate, establishing, you know, regulatory harmony? Or will it create such a heavy, expensive, and restrictive compliance burden that the cutting edge of crypto innovation decides it simply cannot afford to live in this house?
Wow.
Yeah, forcing the industry's brightest minds and deepest liquidity entirely underground or permanently overseas.
It is the ultimate balancing act between safety and innovation. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the systems being built around you. Look closely at the foundation of the technology you use, and we will catch you on the next deep dive.